Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
Right here on WPFW 89.3 FM. That's the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
The heart and soul
of the American labor movement.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
Redeemer, full of culture.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about
it. I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
With the finger roll, plus the foul.
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. This is where sports and politics collide, here at your home for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, WPFW, trying to change the world one broadcast at a time. I'm Dave Zirin. We're joined here by Chuck Modiano. How you doing, Chuck?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, DZ?
Well, I'm doing great because we also have with us, he's had a very busy summer. Glad to have him back in the saddle. And I want to say his name like Oprah, even though I'm mispronouncing it. Eton Thomas, how you doing, sir?
Like Oprah, huh? That was different.
Well, I know. I just am excited to talk to you. And, you know, while your first name rhymes with baton, it's hard to do that Oprah style. I had to go Eton. There you go. So we got so much to talk about between the three of us, much catching up to do at this intersection of sports and politics. I know these two fine folks are going to grill me about my experience in Paris for the Olympic Games, which, believe me, was an eye-opener every which way but loose. And Chuck and I have been hinting about talking about it for several weeks, but we've been caught up with the whirlwind of the world during that time. But before we get into my Paris adventures, I got to just ask you both, Eton Thomas, first and foremost, what have you been up to over the last several weeks, several months? I know you got some changes going on in the house. I know a lot's been going on at the intersection of sports, politics, family, whatever it may be. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, just a lot of family going on. We moved Malcolm into Villanova, so we went up there. That was a big production. Yeah, that's crazy. It's so crazy, you know. And I mean, all the parents out there that have kids as freshmen, incoming freshmen for college. Hey, I'm with you. We need like a support group or something like that. You know what I mean? Because it's a big adjustment. And then right after that, the girls started school, so that was a big adjustment as well. And you know, just a lot of family going on. But it's a great thing. It's a beautiful thing. Not complaining at all.
Yeah, no, I hear you about the support group. I went through it a couple years ago. I'll be going through it with my son in a couple years. It is a whirlwind to feel the absence of that presence in the house.
It definitely is.
Did I hear Villanova?
Yes, Villanova.
You want to talk about that?
I mean, the good thing is it's not that far. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like a 2-hour drive. So it's far enough where, you know, we won't have to do the unexpected pop-ups. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You just turn around and we sitting in the living room or something like that. But it's far enough where you could get there, and you know what I mean? It's good. He's excited. You know, he's ready. He's prepared. You know, everything like that is just, you know, an adjustment for the parents.
Right. No, definitely. And a lot of times, as in my family, more for the parents than the kid.
Yeah.
You know, just that's just the way it works sometimes. So close enough that you can reach out and touch the young man, but far enough that he's not going to knock on your door with a bag of laundry. That's what you're really saying.
Yeah, something like that. Right.
Excellent. Right. Totally perfect. And knowing Malcolm, I know he's psyched about his classes. How's he feeling about the hoop situation there?
Oh, he's feeling good. You know, I mean, he's a freshman. You know, in this new era, you have transfers and fifth and sixth year seniors. So it's a whole different dynamic than it was when I was coming up. But yeah, he's a freshman. He's learning. They worked out during the summer, so he's thrown into it and is gonna learn quick.
And two more questions for you, just because I'm so curious. My father-in-law played football on a scholarship at Villanova. He first member of his family to go to college. So that school is very much in the hearts over here. So two questions for you. I could pass this on to old father-in-law. The first is, Villanova is so marked by the legendary former coach Jay Wright. Mm-hmm. Is he a presence at all around the program at this point?
Yeah, no, I've seen him about 3 times this summer. Wow. He's been at different events. Yeah, he definitely, it's interesting. He definitely is still a presence. I think, and this is just my personal opinion, the change in the dynamic of college sports kind of led more to his departure than anything else. And again, that's my personal opinion. He didn't tell me that. You know what I mean? But it's not a situation where he's, you know, completely just removed. It's just the dynamics have changed. And I think you saw that with a lot of the you know, more seasoned coaches that have been around for a long time. That's, again, just my personal opinion.
Well, I'll just say, if that's the case, then I want to give a lot of credit for Jay Wright to just sort of retreating to the background and not like some of these football coaches we've seen who go out throwing a temper tantrum about the good old days and whining their heads off as they go to the door. I much more appreciate this idea of just saying, okay, well, this is just not for me. And right. I'm going to help build the program and I'll just do it my own way.
Yeah.
I think that's a classier way to do it.
I agree.
Hey, well, one question. I got a question though. Was he considering the alma mater Syracuse of his father? Was that on the table in the decision-making process?
No, it definitely was. But he wanted to go his own direction. You know what I mean? Right. I mean, it's a thing where, you know, a lot comes with that. You know, being the son of someone who went, you know, it's just a lot. So it's going to be good. You know, it's you have to let everybody kind of make their own path and the way that they want to do it. And I definitely respect that.
Yeah. And, you know, two things on that. The first is, you know, not just going to, he wouldn't just be going to Syracuse where you went. I mean, you were an All-American there. So, you know, that is a shadow the young man would have to confront. The second thing I just got to say about that is something that my grandfather always said to me, which is, he said, if you let your child choose their own path, it will always lead back to you. That always got me right in the heart. And my last question, Etan, sorry to give you 20 questions, but my last question is, Villanova has been in the news in the basketball world a lot this summer, between Mikal Bridges signing with the Knicks, between Jalen Brunson taking a ton less money than he could have gotten for the purposes of keeping the quote-unquote Nova Knicks together. They think they have something really special with Brunson, DiVincenzo, now Bridges, the great DC's own Josh Hart. My question for you is, is that translating to the campus or the program at all, the buzz of the Nova Knicks?
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. Everybody's buzzing about that. I mean, it's a special, I mean, you don't, I don't know if I remember the last time where I've seen that many, you know, players from one college even being on a team, let alone that have been teammates. No, it's definitely something special. And for Knicks fans, oh my gosh, Knicks fans are buzzing. You know what I mean? Like ready to get going. So no, it's definitely an exciting time. I'm still not the biggest fan about Brunson taking that much less money. I don't like that trend. I don't like that to that be put on players to have to do that. I don't like that, you know, and it's just, you know, that goes into another topic, but you know, it's the casting of the player as being the either, you know, selfish for wanting to the player's worth or what the market will give the player, or the player being praised for, you know, like in Brunson cases, being selfless and doing the sacrifice for the team. And this is what all players should do if they want their team to get better. I still like that trend. You know what I mean? I'm going to be honest with you. I don't like that trend at all, but that's not what you asked. I just wanted to throw that in there real quick.
No, it's important. And I'm curious what Chuck thinks about that trend, but it almost likes put the onus on the player for ownership and management to handle their own books.
Of course.
It's like, why should that be Brunson's responsibility to make sure they can re-sign their players? Mm-hmm. And it puts it on the player to do that. Now, the one asterisk I'll throw on with Brunson's case, and maybe I'm just doing this because I'm a homer and Jalen Brunson has stolen all of our hearts, so take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. But do you think we can say that it might be a smart move precisely because it's New York and that will afford him getting that sort of beloved response in that city could afford him opportunities that maybe wouldn't exist in another city?
Nah.
I like that argument at all.
I'm a little on the mess side too, because if Jalen, you know it is, Jalen's balling in New York like he did last playoffs, he's going to get his commercial deals no matter what. You already know I'm with Atan on this. We had discussed it. The Knicks are worth $6 billion. James Dolan is worth $2 billion. Let them pay whatever luxury tax they must pay for if Jalen goes over the limit. This is petty cash. This is coins in the couch if you're talking about us over here, for these billionaires. So I'm worried, I'm concerned about the trend that others who may even be in less marketable areas and not have those commercial endorsement opportunities that you just mentioned, it's going to affect them too. And fans are going to expect it, and media is going to push it, that not the owners pay these luxury taxes, but that the players restructure.
Yeah. I don't like that trend at all.
No, I hear you. Atan, I'm hearing your union roots with the NBPA coming up with what you're saying, for sure. Now, Chuck, I got to ask you, first of all, just the basic question of what you've been up to. And then I've got like a very specific question because, you know, you've been all spring. You made this show. You gave this show political weight by speaking about the protests, the encampments. Yes. Around Gaza, against what Israel is doing to Gaza, Israel's war on Gaza, which has been relentless, and now it's being pushed into the West Bank as we speak right now, so it's being escalated. I know that there was a protest of some kind at GW. Were you able to attend that, and do you see the encampments coming back this fall in this area? We've already seen Michigan, and we've seen the police respond to Michigan in a particularly violent way. But what are you seeing right now, and what do you think is going to happen as we enter the fall season?
That's a great question. I was, you know, asking people because, you know, I still have not returned to D.C., so I missed that GW protest. I was at the DNC, and then the week before, I was in Ferguson for Mike Brown's 10th anniversary, and we spoke at length on that, so I don't want to rehash those, but this week I've been really trying to help with legal matters because some of my footage of the protests, both at in Ferguson and at the DNC, with overzealous, overhyped police placing draconian charges in each case on protesters, you know, I've been dealing with a little bit of that behind the scenes and making sure lawyers have footage that goes against maybe what the narrative is. And while I think on the fourth day of the DNC, there was that this great protest in D.C. with the George Washington University students. And there were George Washington University students in Chicago where I was at. So I literally asked them, I say, OK, this looks great. You know what's going on in D.C.? And I'm looking at the video. We're looking at the video together while we're at a Free Palestine protest. And they said to me, something will happen. They don't know what exactly. And the reason why they don't know what, and if they did, they probably, you know, it'd be too early to tell, is that they're making all these different rules right now. You know, a lot of the universities, including George Washington University, but the universities are making these rules. And I would argue 100% that they're unconstitutional, anti-free speech rules. So to just give you maybe the most draconian example is NYU yesterday made Zionist a protected word, like you were a discriminatory word, when we all know Zionist is a political ideology. Well, what about anti-Zionist Jews like myself, like yourself? So if you think about it, if you are calling out someone for being a Zionist and you're saying you're violating campus procedures and we could maybe expel you, let's just imagine for a second if John Hagee, who is the white supremacist head of the Christians United for Israel, which is arguably even larger and just as powerful as AIPAC, what if he enrolled at his advanced age into NYU? He would be a protected member as a Zionist, and if I were to call him out as an anti-Zionist Jew, I could be expelled. This is how ludicrous some of these rules are. So they're doing similar things at the George Washington University, for instance, punishing all the SJPs, for those who don't know, Students for Justice of Palestine. They're not recognizing them. So that's what we're seeing, and the protests will happen in some way, but they're going to have to navigate all of these new anti-free speech, anti-education rules that are put on by so-called places of higher learning, which in reality are lower learning because they don't want to upset their billionaire donors.
Wow. A very interesting situation. It's going to be quite the thicket we're going to see, like during this election season, where these issues tend to get magnified or minimized based on, I mean, it's always a political question, like will the encampments, which no doubt I think will come back, will they be magnified or will they be minimized given the presidential climate? Always an open question.
No, it's not open to me, DZ. And the reason it's not open to me is because having covered 4 days of protests, when I looked at all the headlines that were on the news, they were all minimized. They were small. Like I might have, thousands were flooding the streets saying, Free Palestine, now is the time. To when somebody is running for president, now is the time to pressure them. Not after they get elected, they don't care about you anymore. So now is the time, and the streets were flooded, and we all know about the uncommitted vote. Well, from all the news of how those protests were muted and how the police behaved, they literally stopped one protest before it started, and how much the police were there and how much the media minimized it. Right now, between now and November, whatever happens, I believe, will be muted and will be silenced between now and the election.
Interesting. Time will tell. I thought you were going to go the other way with that, Chuck, and I'm not entirely sure I agree with you this. Time will tell. And you're right. I was following the media very closely at the DNC. Of course, I agree with your assessment about how the protests were muted. I just think it's going to become a lot harder to do so, particularly we know the Democratic Party depends on young voters, and a place like the University of Michigan in a must-win state. I think it could get very interesting, but I don't know. It's going to all depend on how big the protests are, on how clear their demands are, on the response of police and the authorities. There are just a lot of open variables. Yes. Where we don't quite know how this is going to affect the race, the discussions around it, and all the rest of it. Definitely. And there's also a big endorsement that is yet to come in. I'm very curious what Rashida Tlaib, of course, very prominent in Michigan, Palestinian congresswoman, what she's going to do as the election gets close, I think is also going to be a very interesting factor.
Yeah, I think you're right.
We will see.
We will see.
Yes, indeed. So taking it to you, Etan Thomas, should we go to a quick break or should we just keep it going?
Yeah, let's go to a quick break. I definitely want to hear about everything that happened in the Olympics. You had a very unique experience there, so I want to hear about all of your experiences at the Olympics.
Oh goodness, you know I'm mighty shy, but I'll tell you what. Let's take a quick break right now here on The Collision, 89.3 FM WPFW, where sports and politics collide. We'll be back after the break, and you're going to learn about the other side of Olympic Paris.
So, my fight them on the wall of them, Lion, you're not beg no friend from none of them. You fight them on the wall of them, Little lion, not beg no friend from none of them. So do not get no rotty, through them with karate. The old thing still I say, you're the Einstein monarchy. So do not get no rotty, through them with karate. The old thing still I say, you're the Einstein monarchy. The old thing still I say, you're the Einstein monarchy. Why them want to kick out myself for starty? Turbo like a house, myself with turbo like a stalky. Popping on my sword, I know them get marky. How you feeling? I'm feeling naughty. Little I am, well, are you around the party? Now do not know corrupt. I know no naughty. Since the lack of lunch today, I saw the bossy. Me say me fire bomb the wall of them. Little lion, you not beg no friend from none of them. You fire bomb the wall of them. Little lion, you not beg no friend from. Well, that's me rolling around the place with automatic and cartridges. Drum the place, but I don't like to get a dose for double. Any race, what you're doing here, you should be here, you spy on my place. So damn, world is up, cops patrol the place. We don't care, we have bumps, music in the place. Make the pretty ladies, them I show them face. We no want no gun, pan no damn ways. We fire bomb the wall of them, Little lion, you not beg no friend from none of them. You fire bomb the wall of them, Little lion, you're not been no friend from none of them.
We are back here on The Collision, 89.3 FM, WPFW, where sports and politics collide. Obviously, the famous beat from Dr. Dre. What were we listening to just there?
That was Sizzla Kalonji. It was a nice little mix. I went to a Buju Banton concert.
Oh, my God.
On Tuesday, and I heard the DJ play this. Before the concert starts, they're playing. I was like, whoa, this is nice. So I had to go look it up. Shout out to the DJ.
Wow. Amazing. I love that.
Yes.
That was absolutely fantastic.
It was.
Yeah, I was into that. Mike, you were into that?
That joint was fire.
Yeah, it certainly was. So we are back here on The Collision. Yes, I was in Olympic Paris. Yes, this really did happen. An experience the likes of which I will never forget, both in terms of events I saw on the field and experiences I have off the field. We've been teasing this for several weeks. Y'all got questions? I got answers. Bring them on.
Let me hit you with one first, because one of the things that I saw was a lot of problems in France with the, whether it's the police kind of harassing Steph or harassing LeBron, or the organizers or the security not allowing Sha'Carri to go into the stadium at once direction. Did you see it? Just seemed like there was a lot of complaining about the policing there. That's the first question I wanted to ask you. Did you see that, or what was the sense that you got?
Oh, you better believe I saw that. And while I'm certainly not happy that I'm certainly not happy that anybody had to experience the police in any way such as this. I'm certainly not happy about that. That's a terrible thing to experience. I saw Steph Curry's wife, Aisha, was brought to tears by what had taken place. There was a small part of me that was like, wow, them treating it's kind of like what we were talking about with the campus protests, like them treating some of the Olympic stars like this is the only way we're hearing about this.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's the only way we're hearing about it, because what I experienced was a military occupation in Paris. How about this? It was the most number of foreign troops on the streets of Paris since World War II and the Nazi occupation. There was military there from 30 different countries, and they were armed to the teeth, tens of thousands of them across Paris, and another 20,000 undercover just walking around. And the ones who are armed, I got to tell you, like, we're not just talking about, like, a gun on the hip. I mean, we're talking about, like, something from a Transformers movie or Fast and the Furious. Just, like, incredible hardware around everybody's neck. And I'll tell you something, Etan, one of the things that was particularly creepy about it was that, you know, you got soldiers there from 30 different countries, you know, police from 30 different countries, a ton of that. But they weren't wearing any insignia of the country that they were necessarily from. Mm. They were wearing, like, Olympic army uniforms, where the place where their country might be or an insignia, a flag, instead you had the Olympic rings. And it was just like, wait, so who controls the army right now? This army that's patrolling the streets of Paris itself. And I got to tell you, like, I saw some things while I was there that made me wonder what was happening where I wasn't seeing things. Because, like, I interviewed this one woman, and she had a massive bruise on her arm. And she was telling me, and I've got film of this, she was telling me she got the bruise because she was slow crossing the street, and a police car was trying to get through, and it was a little bit chaotic. You know, that'll happen in Olympic cities like this. You know, a lot of people. And one of the army people hit her on the arm with the butt of his machine gun.
Oh, wow.
To get her to hurry up. And this bruise she had was angry. It was an angry bruise. And it just made me think of, like, what's happening that I'm not seeing, especially knowing that 12,500 people were rounded up. A lot of them migrants, a lot of from sub-Saharan Africa were really round up, put on buses and just driven out of the city for the time of the Olympics. Some put in shelters, others just sort of left to their own devices. Families were broken up, which was against the law. But I interviewed people who was like, and Etan, you're not going to like hearing this at all, where they said, women and children first for the shelters. Therefore, if there's a father in the picture, you're going to have to stay behind or track down your family or figure it out. So they were literally breaking up families.
Oh, wow.
To make the city clean, as they would put it. They use this phrase, like, cleansing. It's the for the Olympic Games. And, you know, that was very hard to sort of consume and see. And also, like, at the beginning of the Olympics, it's just like, wow, this is getting no coverage whatsoever. This city is, you know, in an armed state right now. And the last thing, but then things like happened to Steph and Aisha Curry, and it began to get out a little bit. But I could take more discussion about it, frankly. And the one last thing I'll say about it, and I'm sorry for going on so long, but this stuff just, it boggled my mind to see it up close. The one thing I'll say about it is that they'll say, well, it was successful because terrorism is always a risk and there was no terrorism. My response to that would be, if it's all about terrorism, why were there these soldiers miles away from the Olympic venues, just in, you know, poor and working class neighborhoods, standing guard with these guns? Like, why? Why did you need that? And why were peaceful activists, I mean, people who were in peace, pacifist organizations, attempting to do some organizing against what Israel's doing, against war, against the effect of the game, sometimes against the police and military in the streets themselves, why were they targeted? Why were they arrested? I mean, this is something I saw. Like, they were arrested for trying to do a tour of the city where they were taking media members around to look at some of the effects of the Olympics on things like the water supply, on things like some traditional neighborhoods that had been uprooted. They were trying to take media around to show, like, what they called the other side of the medals. That was the name of the organization. It was in French. Please don't ask me to say it in French. And I saw them get arrested by the police. Like, so how is that about fighting terrorism? So for me, it felt like a lot of this stuff being used as a pretext for the purposes of just putting the whole city on lockdown. And I got to say one last thing, too, is that they introduced into the city this kind of, and please don't ask me to over-explain it, but this kind of algorithmic face recognition technology, which previously civil liberties groups have said they don't want it in the city because, you know, these things, they say, well, it's all computerized and we can, you know, like find, you know, if things that are going like prospective terror acts or crimes, like basically we can stop them before they begin with this technology. The problem, though, is that it's human beings who control the technology. That's right. If you don't think these things are going to be racist, for example, if you don't think this kind of facial recognition technology could target people who are just maybe not, you know, just walking like robots to and from work or the metro. I mean, that's what really they're about. It's about social conformity and racial oppression. And yet, you know, they were able to introduce it because of the Olympics. Now, they say they're going to disband it like in 6 months. Why they need 6 months, I don't know. But we've seen in other cities, they say they're going to disband it, and then they just never do. So that was the securitization piece that I saw a ton, and it was very intense.
I got a lot of thoughts. Ton.
Yeah, that's a lot. Go ahead, Chuck.
Sorry.
I have so many thoughts, so I'm going to try to narrow it down because it mirrors so much that I've seen the last couple of weeks, both in Ferguson, both in DNC. There are many illegal arrests. Media were arrested for stepping off the sidewalk, at least 4 media members, but I believe more. And I interviewed many. And then, you know, previously, when we talked about Ferguson and the young man, Elijah Gant, who faces a lot of time, well, they had a drone above. They had a drone above at the DNC and a drone above in Ferguson. And they took pictures of everyone. And they all have facial recognition. I'm sure of myself. I'm in databases across the country. And when they do that, the next day they issue warrants of anyone who touched the fence, because anyone who touched the fence and a piece of the fence came off, and if they shook the fence, they're giving them outlandish charges. I mean, even give felonies, all because of the collision that we talked about that ended in a officer fighting for his life after he banged his head against the concrete. So because of that incident, anyone who was around, that it wouldn't even be a charge. They're giving these draconian charges to. And then to bring it a little back further, when I spent some time in Atlanta on the Stop Cop City movement, I don't think people truly understand. We need a whole show just to talk about that, is that they have a GILI program. And the GILI program is a law enforcement exchange program. And that came after the 1996 Olympics. It was an outgrowth after the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. And it's been exchanged, mostly Israel, not only Israel, but mostly Israel. And then the police officers would go to Israel, learn the tactics of how Palestinians are surveilled before they are, either beaten or controlled. And they bring those tactics back. And the GILEE, G-I-L-E-E, Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange, you could go on their website and just see them, you know, waxing poetic about what's going on in Israel. And when I was speaking to people in the Stop Cop City movement, I was there for a couple of weeks. They're saying this is not just the future in America of mini Gazas that will happen, and why planned cop cities are 69 of them are being planned in the next few years. This is the future of the world, they told me. It's an international exchange. And what the Cop City movement, they're trying to stop the expansion of something like GILI into something much larger. And why is Atlanta ahead of the curve? Because Atlanta has been dealing with this for the last 20 years, starting with their GILI program. So they have a head start of knowledge is what is to be. And what they tell me is that we are gonna have a dystopian, not just police state in America that are mini Gazas, but all around the world. So when I hear you report the way you're reporting of Paris, it's making me think like it's already happening.
Wow. Yeah, it's happening in a lot of places for sure. And, you know, the scary thing about the Olympics is that a lot of times these things can push their way through with less social tumult and protest than, for example, you've seen in Atlanta with Cop City. Like there's, you know, like if in Los Angeles for the 2028 Olympics, they say, well, we're going to need a Cop City to prepare for the Olympics. It has a way of blunting the popular outrage in a way that's very dangerous.
That's absolutely right. And then the last note, I attended both also the RNC in 2016 when
you know, Trump was there. And both at the DNC, but particularly the RNC in 2016, the police were doing completely illegal things. Like they would cut off protests that might, if it was 100, they would try to, bike cops would try to cut you off, and 25, you can't go here, you can't go there. And I start speaking to lawyers. I'm like, isn't this unconstitutional? And what lawyers were telling me was, it's absolutely unconstitutional. The police know it's unconstitutional. They're going to break the law and then deal with that later. If later that becomes all these types of lawsuits, and there will be many, I promise you, coming off the DNC, how the police behave themselves. But they'll deal with those lawsuits, and taxpayers will pay out those lawsuits. But also a lawyer was telling me, and I'm not knowledgeable in that much about this, but they were saying that the police get some insurance company. And what that insurance company says, well, basically, if you end up breaking the law and doing things, the insurance company would often pay out their intentional law breaking. And I don't know the exact intricacies of that, but I do know that the police have mechanisms knowing going in that they could break the law, but get covered and mitigate some of their lawsuit expenses.
Mm. Wow. Thank you for that, Chuck. Yo, it's 10:35. I know it seems like we just took a break, but we got to take one at the bottom of the hour, station break. We'll be back in just a minute with the collision where sports and politics collide, and we're going to hear more about the Paris Olympics, because there's policing, but there's a lot more underbellies that we got to scratch here on the show, if that made any sense. We'll be back right after this on the collision.
Thank you, Lord, for watching me closely. You fill me up with your spirit, you Holy Ghost me. You put my head on straight like it's supposed to be.
Oh, yeah.
I start resisting the devil, so he's supposed to flee. And you restored my soul, you bought me out the dark.
Yes, you did.
Life threw curveballs, you hit him out the park.
Yes, you did.
And you stopped my pain, it couldn't bury me. Even though my mind frame was truth or daring me, I chose truth, and the proof is in your promises.
Yes, and, amen.
And I confess my sins, you love the honestness. I always had the respect for your authority.
Oh, yeah.
But wasn't backing it up with my priorities. I repent, and I know life got valleys and peaks. Feel like I'm peaking, I left them valleys out in the streets. I feel mature now, my thoughts on the holy heavens. Relaying hope in my rhymes for my sisters and brethren. Help them see the light.
Help
I
us.
Pray for all my family, friends, and my loved ones. Apparently, they prayed for me when I was on them drug runs.
Thank you.
Never thought I'd make it back to you. Thought I would die in my sins, cause that's the life I was attracted to.
Lost.
But wise words from my grandpappy. Faith don't quit, and living righteously can keep a man happy. Rest in peace, Bishop Strada. I know you proud of me. Cause everything you stood for is coming out of me. I dropped a tear when I was writing this. Cause God...
We're back here on the collision where sports and politics collide. 89.3 FM, WPFW, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. Atan, what were we listening to there?
That is an artist named Hugh Holla. He's pretty dope. That was, of course, a remix from Jay-Z's Can I Live, and he just kind of flipped it. But, yep, that's Hugh Holla.
I'm sensing a theme with these songs. First of all, Atan, I got to ask you, where do you find the new stuff?
I mean, mostly online. You know what I mean?
Is there a site you go to?
Not specifics. It's just
Pandora.
Not Pandora. It's just online. I usually use Apple Music, and once I hear somebody, you know, you can kind of see where they are. But there's these hip hop discussion groups and these hip hop things, and they'll mention somebody new or they'll say somebody new. I'll look them up, and then I'm like, oh, okay, I haven't even heard of this person. So a lot of times it's like that.
Excellent. Good for me to know, because I find myself just waiting to hear what you're listening to so I can look stuff up. I need something more efficient than that. Okay, so back here in Paris, I'm back there, one of the great cities on earth, but also witness to a lot of injustice. Any other questions, folks, about the experience?
There was so much that was going on, you know. I mean, just talking about, one thing I wanted to ask you as far as the USA team. And you know, yes, they won gold, and they, you know, they, but it seemed like to me, and you could just answer it to me. It's, and I want to see what the overall feeling was, you know, on the ground there. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like a lot of people were kind of rooting for them to lose,
exactly,
so they could kind of continue pushing the narrative that, you know, the world is caught up to the USA basketball. It's not the dream team. American players lack the fundamentals. They don't play team-oriented basketball. Like all those different things that you hear. I kind of felt that that was kind of bubbling, even when they just win by a little bit or they get challenged. I don't know. I just wanted to see if you felt that at all, or was that just more on the American side?
Let me tell you something. There was a lot of anti-USA men's and women's basketball on the ground. Now, a couple reasons for that. One was, you're right, like the world wants this narrative to be true, that the world is catching up. And that was one reason. The other reason, as we saw, is that the French were very viable as competition. And both French teams, you could argue, overachieved, not just in making the gold medal games, but both games being very challenging. You know, in one game there, but for the grace of Steph, the U.S. might actually maybe lose that game. Not the craziest thing, even though people have argued against me on that, that they would have figured it out without Steph. I'm not so sure about that. I felt like he was the only one who really had that sense of the moment and that killer instinct at that moment. I mean, my favorite play was when Steph, at the end, that three that everybody has seen, but when he's double teamed. But what people don't always talk about is that he had LeBron and Durant wide open on the perimeter and still shot the ball.
Yep.
I mean, that was pretty amazing. And but people were obviously rooting for the U.S. to lose. And then of course the women, it was, you know, 1 foot on the line or they would have gone to overtime with that 3-pointer at the end. I'll tell you though, when the men played for the gold and the women played for the gold, this was pretty cool. You guys will both appreciate this. Tickets were through the roof, but you wouldn't even want to go by getting tickets because they set up big screen TVs around the city. And, you know, it was like a party, you know, because people really, you know, were preparing themselves for seeing a true upset. And I'll tell you, Steph hits that three and you could have heard a groan from, you know, from the Eiffel Tower to the Arc de Triomphe. So on that level, it was very cool to see basketball that embraced because I love the sport. And you also had a lot of U.S. sentiment on it. The other thing was the Serbia game. And this was very interesting. This was in the semifinals, U.S. men. And Serbia had a big lead. I think it got up to like 14 points in the fourth quarter. And remember, the quarters are very short. The clock is running. So it's like, wow, is the U.S. really going to come back from this? And I don't know if you had a doubt. A ton. I had much more doubts in the Serbia game, frankly, than I did in the French game. But comeback they did. And it was that in and of itself was something to see. I heard somebody in France say, I thought this was kind of interesting. They said, have you noticed that Serbia is basically all white players? While France and the United States, obviously, that's not the case. And I said, yeah, why is that? And they said, well, unlike France, like Serbia wasn't a colonizing power. So oddly, that got it some rooting interest that they were the non-colonialism team. I just thought was an interesting perspective that I hadn't thought about. But yeah, just an interesting wrinkle. It's not like people were like, yay, the white guys. It wasn't like weird. It was just like
social media, but yeah.
Yeah, maybe on social, but yeah. I mean, that would be a sewer of epic proportions. We know
that is a sewer, yeah.
Social is going to bring the ugly, but it was an interesting thing on the ground. So that was my general take on it, Etan. I don't know what yours was about the basketball scene, but there was definitely this desire for a narrative that the world had caught up to the United States.
It's been a narrative. And, you know, I'll remind you, I quit sports talk radio in 2004, after we lost the Olympics in with a very poorly constructed team and Larry Brown playing the wrong players, to be quite honest with you. And we lost, and the hate and the vitriol, racist hate and vitriol, I might add, that was heaped upon the players for losing. I was so disgusted by it and it being entertained by, you know, so many people in sports radio. I just left the whole medium. I don't know if it's the right thing, but I couldn't take it. And I think you still see remnants of that today, because it always manifests itself in the way you play, and you play selfishly, and some of the things that Atan said. So you hear that language, and there's always a subtext of sort of, you know, racism underneath. But it's this beautiful moment when you think about Serbia and you think about the final, to see LeBron, Steph, and KD together. These are giants of the last 20 years. You know, LeBron goes back 20 years. And this, it's a beautiful final, you know, call for an era of just these greats and working together when you see them cheering each other on. I think it's one of the most beautiful basketball moments ever. That said, when I think of Wemby and how great he will be, and he's going to be a lot better in 4 years. He's going to be the best player in basketball if he doesn't get injured in 4 years. And France having a team. And then we lose the icons that I just mentioned. Not that there aren't good American players. But I'll be honest, I don't know if France is not the more favored team in 4 years from now, giving Wemby and some of the players around him. Legitimately. Just legitimately. And I think that's something we want to think about. That I don't know if everyone's caught up, but I'm going to tell you France is caught up.
Yeah, I'll ask you that, Atan, as someone who played the game at that position. You know, there's a lot of Wembanyama hype. You know it, I know it, the whole world knows it. Do you see in 4 years, he's still so young, for goodness sakes. Could in 4 years he be good enough to actually lift up this entire French team? Another guy, Bilal Coulibaly, is going to be a lot older in 4 years, plays for the Wizards, looked very good in the Olympics, surprised some people given how young he was, that he got some good playing time. What do you think, Atan? Is this French team something to fear in 4 years, or is this a little bit too much Wemby hype?
Well, no, I definitely don't think it's too much Wemby hype. He's definitely going to be special. You know, and I think coming along with that, you're going to see how that can translate to the entire team. I mean, they're talking about that with the Spurs now, you know what I mean? Talking about that with France, you know, in 4 years, I think that comes with it. You know, so I don't know about predictions as well, you know, but one thing I do think is kind of worth noting, as far as with the U.S. team, where everybody, the part of the narrative is the selfish player, the, you know, individual, thing like that. But really, when the players saw that Steph was hot, they just kind of selflessly kept giving him the ball and took a step back. I mean, you know, I think if they wouldn't have done that, you know, you might have seen, you know, a different outcome. I think that's really, you know, because they're all superstars.
Right.
They're all future Hall of Famers. They're all everything. They could have easily been like, okay, that's enough, Steph. Now it's my turn to do. But they just kind of, oh, he's hot. Let's keep giving to him. Let's clear it out for him. Like, keep on going. And they're cheering him. And I thought that was really beautiful to see, me personally. But
that's a great point.
Yeah, I didn't hear that point being made anywhere, though.
No, that's a great point. Like, and you felt it particularly, this is my opinion, you felt it particularly among the older heads. LeBron, Durant, Steph, this sense, Drew Holiday, you know, you sensed this like, okay, we're going to play like a team. We're going to get it to the right people. We're going to play a role. I'll put Anthony Davis in this category, who I thought was just fantastic during the Olympics. That was cool. I agree with you about that. It was almost like had like a last hurrah feel. Like, this is our last Olympics. We're going to do this right and do it properly. And if Steph's hot, then so be it. If KD wants the big shot at the end of the game, so be it. If LeBron wants to run the point, so be it. I did like the feel of this team a great deal. That was great for me. But, Atan, you talked about everybody cheering. I'd be remiss if I did not ask you about Jason Tatum and how all of that was handled by Steve Kerr, by Jason Tatum's mom complaining publicly, by the owner of the Celtics complaining publicly. What was your take on everything Jason Tatum?
I mean, I still go back to Jaylen Brown not being on the team. I mean, I think there's definitely a lot that you could discuss, but you know the caliber of player that Jason Tatum is. So yes, it definitely was a head scratcher as far as why he wasn't really utilized. And they were kind of, it seemed like the media was looking for any reason to say, oh, he's upset. Oh, he's like, no, I'm cool. I'm just here. I'm working. You know what I mean? I'm happy for the guys. I'm glad he handled it that way. Can't speak for his mom. You know, his mom went on social media, whatever. But he handled it the right way. And I think that was a good example for, a lot of younger players who are watching this, who aren't getting the playing time that they want, who feel that they should be playing. They could look at how Jason Tatum handled a very difficult situation over there and handled it like a professional. So I look at it that way. Look at it as a positive.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that 1,000%, for sure. Now, very cool situation up and down the line. I'll just say that it was great to see Hoops feel like an organic part of everything that was going on. That's always one of the things that I think is appealing about the Olympics. As you have these stars who are a part of it, you also have people living hand to mouth. One thing I'll tell you both that didn't make a lot of news, which I thought was interesting. The athletes' village, where almost everybody stays, you know, not the NBA dudes, but where like 95% of all the athletes stay in the athletes' village, and they had a health center in the village, a wellness center, where they offered free health care for the duration of the Olympics. And in some of these countries, including the United States, the healthcare system is so bad that people were going to the health center in the athlete's village for things like checkups. I mean, people were getting regular, normal health care taken care of in the village because they couldn't get it back home. And wow, that did not get a lot of publicity either.
Wow. I had an experience like that overseas that I was blown away. I was in Macedonia and blown away at health care I received when I had a sickness incident. And it ended up costing me $500. It would have cost me like $20,000 here. It was just amazing. Yeah, it was like, so I understand. I absolutely understand that.
Yeah. This is like stethoscope stuff I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay.
Like the most basic healthcare, a checkup people were going in for.
Right. No, I mean, it makes sense. I do the same thing. A lot of people when they're overseas, they're like, hey, let me take care of this so I could take care of it at a much cheaper cost, and or by drugs. If you buy prescription drugs overseas, it's like, I don't know, 5% or less of what it would cost in America.
Exactamundo.
Yeah. But you know what, I think is interesting. Go ahead.
Hopefully, we got time for probably one more question if you want to throw it on.
You know what? If we got time for one more question, put what happened in Paris and what you saw in Paris in the context of, I believe a couple of days ago, President Macron had said he is not noticing, accepting the incoming leader, which sounds a lot like almost a coup or a dictatorship move. And could you put that in perspective with what you saw?
Oh man, what a big question. I'll just
do it in 60 seconds.
Yeah, I'll answer this very briefly. The left, called the New Front Populaire, they won like in an upset that people didn't expect. People poured out and voted for them instead of an openly fascist party. And what I saw in Paris was that people were like partying still from the election. People were so, because Paris was like point zero for all of the organizing. And people were just like on cloud 10, like, wow, we beat them. Now we got the Olympics. We're feeling good. You know, a lot of that vibe was out there, even with all the heavy policing. And so I think it's very interesting that now I believe that the Olympics were kind of used as a ruse to narcoticize people, to keep them calm, to keep them, you know, just kind of like in a different kind of headspace. And then you come in with something like this and it's like whiplash for the people. So I think, frankly, you saw this in Brazil, too, after 2016. And maybe I'll even write about this, is that the political impasse almost gets solved by the Olympics in a way that's very bad for the people in the country.
Can you write a book on all your Olympic experiences and tie the trends together?
Is that a next project for you?
Only if Etan writes the intro. we've run out of time, fellas. This was a lot of fun, as always. So glad to be talking with you both, chopping it up. For everybody out there listening, you can still give the WPFW. We got the Cash App, which is $WPFWFM. We got the website, WPFWFM.org. Even though fundraising period is done, fundraising period is actually never done. Any last words to Tom before we go?
No, it was great. Great. I'd like to hear what Chuck has lining up as far as protest-wise.
Yeah, Chuck, anything quick you want to throw on us?
10 seconds. It's hard for me to say. Look out for the universities and write that book, DZ. Write that book.
Okay. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.
This Labor Day, September 2nd, WPFW centers programming celebrating workers with The Grind, Work, Resistance, and Hip Hop. From 9 a.m. until 1 p.m., we'll hear from workers about conditions, organizing, and resistance, as well as present our annual survey of labor music. At 1 p.m., WPFW's Decipher Collective takes over until midnight, with hip-hop reflecting the highs, lows, and mid-ranges of the daily grind. That's The Grind, Work, Resistance, and Hip-Hop. This Labor Day, 9 a.m. until midnight, on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Mumia Abu-Jamal reminds us that August is a month of repression, of radical resistance, of injustice and divine justice, of righteous rebellion, of individual and collective efforts to free the slaves and break the chains that bind us. On August 29th, from 1 until 7 p.m., through both public affairs and music, WPFW reflects on the origins of Black August and honors the lives and legacies of Jonathan and George Jackson and all Black freedom fighters as we recommit to the sovereignty and resilience of Black people around the world. That's Black August, Thursday, August 29th, 1 until 7 p.m. on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Beloved listening audience, thank you so much for your tremendous support. Your unwavering dedication has taken WPFW over our goal despite a cyber attack. We are grateful for your generosity. It ensures that WPFW can continue to serve the people through our mission. If you missed the opportunity to pledge, you can visit WPFWFM.org to make a donation at any time. Together, we can build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Branford Marcellus, and when I'm in the D.C. area, I listen to WPFW.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words, Beats, and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C., at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right, all right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details and how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 20-